Love this podcast? Support this show through the supporter feature from Acast. It's up to you how much you give and there's no regular commitment. Just hit the link in the show description to support now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/news ad free. That's amazon.com/news ad free to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Attention, collectors of vinyl. Have you ever gone into a record store and felt overwhelmed by all the unfamiliar options? Are you frustrated by the constantly increasing prices of classic rock staples? Do you avoid streaming music or long for the days when music was recommended to you by a friend instead of an algorithm? If the answer to any of these questions is yes, then check out I'd Buy That for a Dollar, a podcast about inexpensive, common, and underappreciated records that are waiting to be rediscovered. Each week, hosts Sean, Jeremy, and Peter discuss an album and the artist's history. Previous episodes include selections by the Isley Brothers, the Carpenters, the Doobie Brothers, and Donna Summer, among others. Become a bargain bin pro and impress all your friends with cool music trivia. Listen to I'd Buy That for a Dollar wherever you get your podcasts. Please consider supporting Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. You can learn more about them at bwunited.ca. They are always looking for donations and volunteers. So please, again, support Black Women United YEG for the protection and advancement of Black women and girls in Alberta. Again, that website is bwunited.ca.
Hey, this is Nicole calling from Hamilton, and I needed to let everyone know that I really proudly support Vish and Creative Control. I have for many years, I will for many more, as long as he keeps delivering these amazing interview podcasts. When you hear one of Vish's interviews, you think he's known this guest for years, they're good friends, but the truth is he approaches every interview, whether it's sort of up-and-coming indie artists or established icons or like famous intimidating comedians with a really deep, genuine curiosity, so he's never met this person, and the same really warm candor, as so he's known them forever. I think it really lends to a great chat, no matter who he's talking to, and for that reason, I think you should throw Vish, like what, $1 a month? He's got jokes. The jokes make it worth it. Support Creative Control on Patreon.
To make your flexible monthly donation to Creative Control, please visit patreon.com/creativecontrol today. I'm Visha's wife, and remember, when you name a dog Janet or Timothy, you are dragging humanity down just a little bit.
Azita is a wondrous musician based in Chicago, Illinois. Over the past 30 years, via bands like the Scissor Girls and Bride of No-No, and then performing under her own name, Azita has made some truly alluring and fascinating albums. Her latest is called Glen Echo, which was released by Drag City Records on March 5th, 2021, and features Azita playing and recording every single instrument herself at home, all of which occurred pre-pandemic. Sometime after Glen Echo came out, and while America was just starting to creep out of its darkest COVID days, Azita and I connected for a good talk about comedy and her family, her time as a student at the Tehran American School in Iran, and then moving to the Washington, D.C. area, where she was somewhat immersed in the local punk and Discord Records community, her move to Chicago to pursue art and eventually music, her shift from piano to guitar on Glen Echo, and the late David Berman's guiding hand towards her musical self-sufficiency, future plans, and much more. A part of the Entertainment One Network with the support of listeners like you who follow and subscribe to this podcast and spread the word about it and make flexible monthly donations at patreon.com/creativecontrol, plus in-kind support from Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton. This is the 613th episode of Creative Control, featuring the thoughtful, talented, and very funny Azita, with your host, me, Vish Khanna. Hi, Zita. How are you?
I'm good. How are you?
I'm well. I'm well. It's nice to speak with you. Where in the world are you today?
I'm in Chicago.
Chicago is a lovely town. I don't know if I'll ever get to visit it again because of the pandemic and whatnot.
Oh, come on. It's almost over.
You think?
I do think, yeah. I think everyone's, you know, the vaccination is going to, you know, hopefully make it so that we're not in this situation like a year from today. I wouldn't expect it to be similar anymore.
Okay, that's heartening to hear.
I don't think it's that, like, you know, I don't think I'm being excessively optimistic or anything by saying that.
Well, where I'm calling you from in Edmonton, Alberta, as we're speaking, like, the numbers are spiking. There's a variant and people aren't. This vaccine is making some people feel like they're superhuman. They don't need to wear the mask. They don't need to socially distance.
Right, yeah.
And so I think it's and then, you know, Bonnaroo, as we're speaking, like, the Bonnaroo Festival is like, we're doing it. And I feel like this creates like a psychological.
Are they really?
Yeah. They schedule their dates for September and then it's all the people are playing. So I feel like psychologically, this has all been very psychologically interesting, isn't it? Just the way people behave when they get different pieces that, like, oh, they're loosening up, so that means it's normal. No, it doesn't. And then, oh, they're locking down. That still means we can act normal. You see where I'm coming from?
Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, it's been strange. How has life been for you in Chicago in this strange era?
I haven't left the house at all. Like, we do the curbside pickup for groceries and stuff. Like, I haven't gone into a store since this time last year or whatever.
Right.
We're like really, really strict with our behavior, and I have a luxury that I don't have to like go anywhere, you know, for work or anything, and we don't have kids, so, you know, people with kids have a different situation altogether. Like, they have to do things, you know, like.
Yep. I have kids. So, my wife just took them out of the house so we could have a nice quiet chat.
Right. I get that. Like, it's not easy for people to do what I've been doing, but I actually have, you know, well. If you've heard my record, I did all that here in the house, so I'm used to not leaving the house.
Yeah.
You know, like, I didn't leave for 5 years, so this is just like the same shit. So
it's striking to me that in the context of me coordinating an interview with you, you said, if you've heard my record. Is there a chance? Did you think there was a chance that I would arrange a conversation with you and not listen to a lick of your new album? Did you really think that?
Well, I think that the thing that I just said about how long it took would not necessarily come across in just one song of listening to it. So maybe, you know, yeah.
I see. So your sort of decision, I suppose, to create this album, which is beautiful and lovely and tonally haunting, like it gets under my skin a little bit. It's rubbery, if I might use a term. I like it. It's called Glen Echo, and are you suggesting that you just inferred that you made it all on your own and playing everything? You made this decision to be completely self-reliant and self-sufficient well before many of your peers have been forced to do such things because of the pandemic.
Yeah, this record was actually mastered and being pressed at the time that this shit started to happen.
Weird. So, like, wow.
Yeah, so it was done. I mean, like, it was mastered in November of 2019, and the original release date was like in, you know, June or whatever of 2020. Mm. And even that was just because it took a while to get the covers and stuff. You know what I mean? Like, so it was done. And it was done recording, like, and then needed to be mixed. And I was mixing at the Wilco Loft, and it's hard to get time there because, you know, you're at the mercy of when they don't need the place,
yeah,
or whatever.
Right,
so,
right.
Yeah, it took a long time. And a lot of the time that was like the long time of it was waiting for shit that I had to wait for. You know, that wasn't like just me taking long to work on it, but was like, you know, can't get into the studio to mix the next song. Like, you know, we got two songs mixed and then like we had to wait like 2 months before we could get into mix. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah,
just like,
yeah,
just that kind of thing where you're just like, oh my God, when is this going to be done? So it's sort of painful that everything that, like, if I do read a bit of press on this, it's like, it's been 8 years. It's been 9 years. I'm like, shh. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
Because it shouldn't have been, like, you know, like, it was like, years kept getting added for things that had nothing to do with me, you know? Like, and then the icing on the cake was this corona thing made it take another year, basically.
But if you had it on the books for June 2020, what, you're saying there were just other things that popped up? Or was it the pandemic that pushed it back?
It was the pandemic that pushed it back. Well, at the time that this happened, it was being pressed, and they physically stopped the pressing plant.
Oh,
you know?
Right.
It was like they weren't going to go in and keep making records.
Right.
And then so there was that delay. And then also part of the conception of this release was that I had to have that music video. And our day of shooting for the music video was March 16th. That's when we had the Art Institute's studio booked to go in,
man,
and shoot the music video.
Okay.
And so that was the first day of lockdown in Chicago. So it was like we had to cancel. I mean, we worked so hard on planning that day and how it was going to go and had to like cancel that. And then it was like, okay, well, we're going to resume production of, you know, Drag City was like ready to resume production. But I couldn't get back into the Art Institute to shoot the video. And I was like, I really just don't want to have the record come out without the video with it. It was part of the sort of conception of how I wanted the record to go. So
okay. Okay.
Yeah.
What is the significance of the video from your perspective exactly? Why do they go hand in hand?
Because I think that, like, if have you seen the video?
No, so yeah, I've already sort of defended myself as being an ardent listener of your new album, but I must confess,
you
I
haven't
don't
seen the video.
I
okay,
don't,
well, then it's not going to make any sense.
No, but I think all of us, this is why you're here. You're going to get us to listen to things and watch things. I'm sorry, I didn't watch the video. I can't watch. Don't you find there's so many videos and live streams and like it's exhausting?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at some point,
But the thing is I can't tell you. I can't tell you because then you can't see it with fresh eyes.
Okay, don't.
So I
okay,
feel that, like,
fine.
I feel like I can't tell you.
Now, is it a video for a specific song?
It is a video for a specific song. Yeah, it's for the song called If You Die.
Okay.
And when I was writing the song, I kind of imagined how the video would go. And actually, what's interesting here in this track, in this sequence of songs, you know, is that they're kind of in the order that they were written. It's not like something that typically happens, but they, you know, when I went to do the sequencing of the album, it was like, no, the order that the songs belong in is in this order. And it just so happens to be the order that they were written in, right?
I see.
So it was one of the earlier songs because most of the songs were done before, like writing wise, were done before Trump took office or before Trump was elected.
Before?
So,
wow.
So,
okay.
Yeah. So, yeah, I know. Everything just takes fucking forever, you know? So it's like, so it was the last three songs were the only things that weren't done yet. And some parts of those were done, but not, you know, they weren't done. So I don't know, like when I was writing that song, I saw this video at the same time in my mind for what, I, you know, not exactly everything about it, but some of the ideas in it. And so it was kind of like growing with the idea of the record at the same time, you know. So
okay.
So that I can say that. And also, like, you know, the video to me sets up how you should kind of imagine the rest of the record, you know. So
well, that's fascinating on a couple levels because to my recollection, If You Die, the song, appears about halfway through.
No, I think it's like third, maybe.
I think it's fourth.
Is it fourth?
It's like there's 8 songs, I think, and I think
I should know.
I'll pull it up. I'm pulling up the one sheet here. I've got it handy, actually.
It says here
1, 2, 3, 4. I've got Glen Echo, Online Life, Two Brutal Moving Parts, If You Die.
Okay, so interesting. I think that then in that case, I take back. Really, is it really in that order?
Well, hang on. Let me also.
You might be right. I think that then in that case, three and four are.
It is. I'm looking at my music library too. So I was looking at the one sheet. Those could be wrong. That could be wrong. But when I
right. No, you're right. You're right. I'm looking at it now too. Yeah, I think that unless I'm now not remembering how I wrote this, I think that this is true. That three and four are backwards in how I wrote them. That's all.
May I interject and ask Azita? Have you listened to your album? I just want to put the shoe on the other foot because you don't seem to know a lot about how it was. No, I'm just.
Well,
I'm
let me tell you
teasing.
This. I have not listened to my album. I did actually listen to the album like a few times in a row on the day that it came out.
Good.
Just to imagine other people listening to it. But in general, I don't sit around and listen to my own things. But at the time, again, this took me like 5 years of working on it. At the time, I listened to everything so many millions of times that, But I think that what happened here is that those tracks 3 and 4 are actually one of the small parts of this set of this like list here where they weren't done in that order. I think that they were written in opposite order, and I think that this was a sequencing decision that I made because I felt that there was something a little bit more similar between 3 and 5, and I wanted to separate them. And I think that that's what I did is I switched them that way.
Okay, so in a real world scenario. If You Die would be the third song, not the fourth song.
I think so, right. But you know, maybe I'm not remembering correctly.
No, it's,
my memory is not the best for all kinds of things like this.
This is not an interrogation. No one is going to jail as a result of the facts that are brought to the fore here. All I'm asking, though, is If You Die is halfway through the record as we are now experiencing it, but you view it, oddly enough, and I'm not trying to make a pun here, you view it as a central song to this record.
I don't view the song as central. No. I view the concept of the video that went with it as central.
But you don't want to talk about the concept of the video without us watching it. So I have to, when people get this podcast, I will specifically link to the video.
You should link the video.
Just so they can watch it and click on it. And we've left some...
Yeah, I mean, it's self-explanatory. Once they see that, then they'll know what I meant. And then everything will make sense.
Well, there's some pretty evocative and clever... There's lots of funny lyrics, I think, on your record. And,
thank you.
And even the song If You Die begins with, "If you die and he does not, give my condolence to your friend." That's like a joke. That's like almost like stand-up comedy. And I like that. So I feel like, is there levity? Do you view this as a record full of levity, even though it's covering sort of odd human interaction on some level?
I think that it is sort of my way, you know, like I don't think of it as myself sort of like making light. It's just that my way of writing, you know.
Expressing yourself.
Yeah, it's sort of like how I feel, you know. It's not me attempting to express myself. It's just that, like, it would come out because this is, like, my way of being, I guess. Is that, like, I have part of me that, like, laughs at everything. So I guess it's like that.
Do you have particular heroes in the realms of comedy?
Ooh.
Anything?
That's interesting. I'm not like a person that follows a lot of things, like, you know, like I'm not like a super fan, but I can definitely like point to, you know, figures or whatever in the history of comedy that I would say like, oh, I love that person, or I love, you know, obviously, like, you know, Richard Pryor, Eddie Murphy, currently like John Mulvaney. Like, I mean, I haven't been seeing the more recent stuff, but that one thing that was like a while back, the thing, like one of the specials that was like really big, like the thing about when he's going to marry his girlfriend, or, you know, and they're like about the cow. Like, yeah. Why buy the cow? Like, we had died about that so much. Oh, and the iced tea bit, like the thing about iced tea. SVU. Yeah.
No, he's very funny, and I got to speak to John. I'm a huge fan of John's, and he was on the show once too, actually. I love him, and I wish him well. I was going to actually reach out to him to see how he was doing and just say we were thinking of him, but I'm sure he's been Maybe he hasn't been inundated with that. Maybe I'll still do it. So anyway, my point is, was your family like into comedy? Because I got into comedy as a young person, mostly from what I saw.
No, so like I'm saying, like I wouldn't say I'm into it any more than I'm like into like, you know, just regular things in life. Like I'm not like, I don't follow, you know.
No, I gather that. Yeah. But was your family funny? Did you come up feeling funny or no?
Interesting. That's an interesting question. I've never thought about that.
I am so full of interesting questions. It's not even funny.
That's why you do this for.
Yeah. No, I'm just curious because
I was going to say for a living, and then I was like, I wonder if that's really it.
Kind of, sort of. Yeah, it is one of the things I do for a living. Anyway, let's not talk. This isn't about me and me, and you're not my guidance counselor. So let's bypass all of this. No, I'm just curious if.
I'm also curious about this. I have not actually thought about my family as being particularly funny or not funny before. I kind of don't think so. I mean, I kind of don't think that they necessarily are. I don't know.
Did you ever make fun of your family to your friends? Like, you won't believe what so-and-so said or made me do. Like, do you ever have that stuff? Hmm. You have funny stories?
I mean, I guess there was a little bit of comedy. It's hard to say. You know, I'm Iranian. Like, I'm fully
exactly.
an Iranian person. Yeah. I have no. I got none of this European shit at all. Right? And so, like...
okay, none of it. Good, good.
And so, like, you know, there are at least things that I've taken... And maybe, you know, maybe I'm incorrect about this, but there's things I've taken as being like, you know, cultural hand-me-downs that I believe that I would not have if I was a European person. And one of them is that, like, you know, we're fucking loud. You know, there's no, we've never had, in my family anyways, there's never any kind of like sense of reserve,
yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Or like, you know, or whatever. So, you know, like, if someone comes in and you're like, you like that person, you're like, I love you, you know, like, it's like that, right? It's not like, you know, like, none of this, like, you know, like.
But are you?
Yeah, so I guess that there's a loudness.
Are you first generation?
I have looked up that term, and I have tried to, it apparently gets used in more than one way. I am an immigrant as well as I am a child, you know, like I am also an immigrant. I'm also a person that was born here just by chance because my parents were here. My parents were in the States doing a medical residency. So they had me and my sister. Then we went back to Iran and then we lived in Iran as though that was going to be forever. Right. We had no reason to leave.
Oh,
so like I grew up living in Iran.
Oh, OK.
And then, you know, the revolution happened and then it was like, OK, we got to get out of here. So then at that point I was an immigrant, you know. So, yeah, I guess it's complicated. I don't know.
That is complicated. I was my parents are from India and they moved here and then I was born in Canada and I've been to India. I've been back once.
But you've gone back as a visitor, not like as a person who like you didn't have an experience of living there as though that was the place you were growing up.
I was there for 6 weeks in 1989. It felt like I lived there. It just felt like I was never going to get to go home. It was a little weird. For me at the time, I didn't appreciate what an amazing experience that was to get to go. And I remember it. I have a lot of sense memories of this time.
I see. You were very young.
I was like 12 years old or something.
Oh,
yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So my point though is, growing up, I knew there was a. I couldn't identify it, but there was a cultural clash between what my home life was like and what it was like when I went out to play road hockey or go to school, and then that created that tension. In retrospect, created a lot of comedy. Or if I didn't see the comedy in it, I would collapse in a heap of confusion.
Right.
So I guess it sounds to me like so when you came back from Iran, because you had to flee, I'm gathering, how old were you when you got back here, so to speak, back to North America?
I had just turned nine or I was about to be nine.
Okay. So you had...
I want to say just to be clear too, is that Farsi is my first language.
Farsi,
so I had to learn
okay.
English.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
So I learned English when I was in Iran. I went to a school that was called Tehran American School, and it was... I feel like this is sort of like the most globally fascinating part of my life in a way, you know, is that I went to this school that was set up for children of Americans living in Iran. right?
Oh.
And you couldn't get into it if you were Iranian, but I happened to be able to get into it because I had American citizenship from birth, right? But if I had been a run-of-the-mill Iranian, I wouldn't have been able to get into it, I don't believe, right?
Okay.
So the school was huge. Like, it was like, if you imagine, like, the hugest American high schools, right, like, thousands of kids, like, it looked, as I recall, and, you know, some of my memory might be a little
sure.
bit off, too.
Sure, you were only nine.
It's a long time ago.
Oh, yeah, well, yeah. less than nine, yeah.
Or even less,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, yeah.
But it was like a huge school. It was out by the mountains, and it went from, like, the youngest kids, like, kindergarten or whatever, all the way through, like, I think even past high school or something. Like, I don't know if it did. Yeah, it just seemed like there was, you know. And I have a couple of the yearbooks that somebody gave me later after I was in the States. I don't think they're yearbooks. I'm not in them. But if you look at the yearbooks, it's sort of like an American yearbook with, like, football and stuff. And they're like, we are trying to make the people's lives as much as if they were still in the States as possible. You know. Mm-hmm. And so it's all like football and cheerleaders. And if you look at all the pictures of the kids, like, you know, in the yearbook, you can every once in a while see a person that isn't white. But it's mostly all just like white people.
Huh. That is, you know, really interesting, actually.
And,
yeah.
Yeah, and I went to the school, and I remember in my class that you weren't allowed to speak Farsi because the teachers were Americans and they didn't understand it, and they didn't want, you know. So I remember, like, I was learning English and I wasn't that great at it yet, and, like, I remember one of my, you know, memories is of using this word, and I think the word is hose, right? I think that if I was to spell it in English letters, it would just be like a garden hose or whatever.
Sure.
But it's a pool. It's like a little, like, pool that's in the back of, at least was in my backyard. And I used to say it was in all Iranian backyards, but then I realized that might not be true for, depending on, like, economic, you know, class or whatever. But it's like a little pool that's in the backyard. And I would say, you know, small, like, whatever, 5 feet or whatever. And it's called the hose or that, you know. And no one in my class knew what I was talking about. And they all started laughing at me. They're like, what are you talking about, pantyhose, you know. And I just remember this, like, sense of, like, just sort of, like, falling, you know. Like, my sense of sense falling, where it was like I thought something made sense and it didn't make sense.
Right.
You know? And it's sort of like a very profound experience to me that I kind of, like, can always sort of feel that, you know, like, I know what that feels like, you know.
The difference. You felt different.
It's not just about identity, you know.
Yeah.
It's about one's sense of knowing things in the world.
Right.
Right, of having made sense of the world. You know, it's sort of like I imagine, like, this is how I imagine, like, having Alzheimer's or something. You know, like, it's something like where all of a sudden, like, nobody understands you.
Right.
You know? Yeah, but that's what it was like. You know, that's what the Tehran American School was like. And I imagine that that's what it's like, you know, that's what Americans going into the world and deciding to take over parts of other places, you know?
Yeah.
That's a very emblematic.
Yeah. So you had American teachers in Iran. Yeah. What were those teachers like? Mm-hmm.
I can't remember that much. I mean, I want to say that some of this was, like, you know, first grade or, like, kindergarten.
Oh, okay.
You know, like, it was really, because I, you know, so I don't remember that many things about it. It's very, very vague.
I'm just trying to imagine what would make an American go to Iran to teach.
Oh, I see. I can tell you that. Okay. Well, at the time, you know, there was a lot of business going down in Iran and Tehran. So there was lots and lots of Americans there. That's why they had to have the school.
Okay.
Like,
okay.
You know, it was like on TV, you know, they had two channels. They had the Iranian channel and they had the American channel. Mm. So it was like, I think the oil business is my guess, right?
Yeah. Yeah. Right. Exactly. Yeah. Sure. Yeah.
Right. And, you know, you can see then that this type of exploitation that was a direct line to the revolution that happened, you know, like, it's like, yeah. But yeah, like, Americans were, like, you know, people who here would have, like, a middle class standard of living were able to live in Iran and have, like, maids and, like, chauffeurs and
right.
shit, you know. So it was
right.
like, it was like,
it was appealing. It was appealing to work there. Right.
Yeah.
Okay. So you move to America when you're, like, your family moves when you're nine. Because you attended this American Tehran school, was it easy to adjust when you got here?
No. It was not easy to adjust because we were in the middle of the hostage crisis. So, like, I pretty soon after my second year here, I went to a private school in Maryland, in D.C. area.
Yeah.
And everyone was like, you took our hostages, you know, and they...
Oh, the race, they were racist.
I was like an outcast. I was like an outcast for quite a while in my elementary school, I felt like.
Oh, man. I'm sorry to hear that. Did you grow up in D.C. then?
Yeah.
Okay. So are you connected with, like, the Discord Records people in any way? Or?
Yeah. So, like, sometime around, like, whatever, 15 or 16, I started to then partake in, like, not necessarily that scene right away. It was more of, like, just, like, the bigger hardcore scene, you know? And, mm-hmm. and some of it was, like, had an opinion of Discord as being, you know, like, with a straight edge and, you know what I mean? Like, you know, we were doing different kinds. I don't know what I want to say on, you know, but let's say we were doing not straight edge things. You know?
I get it. I think I know what you're saying, and I don't think it's incriminating at this point that you might have been doing other things, but this is what we're talking
about. Let's just call it other things.
Yeah. We're talking about late 70s, early 80s. Is that right?
No. We're talking about, like, I want to say, like, 85, 86.
Oh, mid 80s. Sorry. Right. Okay. Yeah. I was trying to... The hostage crisis was a bit before my time. That's around.
But that's when I was like in elementary school.
Right, and
I went to the school. By the way, the school that I'm talking about, I went, and I don't necessarily want to actually draw attention to the school, but I went to like the same school in the States from third grade through I graduated high school. So I was there for 10 years.
Oh, okay. So yeah, sorry, I was just trying to peg when this occurred because in my mind. Wasn't the Iran Contra scandal somewhere around there, mid 80s?
Contra is different though, right?
Yeah. No, I'm wrapping my head. I'm just sorry.
Yeah.
You're right. We're doing a little impromptu history lesson for me. Thank you. No, I'm just trying to put my.
Don't make me go to fucking Wikipedia right now. I don't remember.
Anyway, you
I don't
grew
remember
up...
what Oliver North trials were into.
I think I watched it. I watched it as a kid. I was fascinated
wasn't
by it.
Was it late 80s or early 90s?
It was like 86, 87, 88, something like that. Yeah, I don't remember. Yeah. Anyway, my point here is this. You're saying you weren't necessarily abiding by what you thought the ethos of the Discord scene was, but you were aware of it? Were you a part of it in some way?
I was not a part of it. No. I'm saying that we would go see stuff like, you know, I don't know, fucking like 7 Seconds, Circle Jerk. You know what I mean? Like that kind of hardcore.
You would see the bands, yeah.
Like,
yeah.
And some of the bands would be Discord bands because there was lots and lots of shows, you know. And actually, I went to a lot of mod, like ska type shows as well.
Okay.
Yeah. Like, so the main takeaway is I went to lots and lots of shows.
Did you see like Embrace or Fugazi? Or
I saw the bands that I saw were like Soulside, Kingface. I was at the first Fugazi show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Nation of Ulysses came later. Yeah, like, who else was it? The, you know, Swizz, Government Issue. There's this kind of, like, time of bands like that, I guess.
Yeah, no, that's remarkable. You probably didn't think, what was the first Fugazi show like? Does it stick out? Do you have a...
Now, if I'm remembering correctly, it was outside at DuPont Circle.
I thought their first show was at the Wilson Center. But maybe I'm...
So
maybe
I'm, I was at, I think I was at that too, but I thought that the outdoor one was... Fun, but my
maybe.
Memory of it is really bad. And I have to say that, like, I was not necessarily, you know, all there...
fully engaged.
with my attention.
Right.
You know, with my...
Got it. Okay. Okay, but so was that... So for some of us, in retrospect, who weren't around, that seems like it would have been a pretty inspiring situation to be even, you know... marginally involved in but it sounds to me like you were going through some stuff and
I would say that like so I had no musical sense of wanting to participate in music at that time. I had piano lessons when I was younger and then I had quit piano lessons by this time and I didn't remember anything about, you know, music or whatever insofar as practicing it or being a practitioner. And so I was around this sort of scene for a while. And then towards the end of the time, I started to become friends with more people that were playing music, like in Nation of Ulysses. And, you know, I was friends with Guy a little bit.
Yeah.
And so I was kind of like seeing the sort of more like watching from the side of the stage or sometimes the backstage or, you know what I mean, kind of thing, like where you're kind of like seeing people, what they're doing. And so I started to kind of then by the time I was like, I'd moved to Chicago to go to the Art Institute, and kind of by the time I was in my second year is when we decided to start a band.
Okay, so maybe it wasn't apparent to you at the time, but maybe all of that experience you had just watching people subconsciously filtered into like, I can do this.
Exactly.
Right. Okay.
Yeah.
So you moved to Chicago for school, ostensibly. Your family's still, are they around still?
They're in the D.C. area.
D.C. area.
My mom passed away in 2015, or 2016. My dad is still there, yeah.
I'm sorry for your loss there.
Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so you get to Chicago, and now you're making music. What was your first band?
Well, my first band was the Scissor Girls, but it wasn't my first year here. My first year, I went to school to be, I don't say to be, because I never had like, I was, you know, people are like, I always knew I wanted to be a blah, 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 and I've never had that.
No.
I still don't have that.
Okay.
You know, so I never had that feeling of, but, you know, like my main skill or like my first skill or like the thing that was like, I guess the thing that I had the most confidence in always was my drawing ability, you know, drawing, painting.
Yeah.
So I went to school and I guess my idea was that I was just going to be doing painting and stuff. I had gone to a pre-college like sort of painting thing too at Carnegie Mellon. And I guess I thought that like that's what I was going to be doing. And I like sort of was working with that at school. And at the same time, my second year is when we started Scissor Girls. Then that sort of started taking over what I wanted to be involved in.
Now, I had the experience growing up with very practical immigrant parents. You know, they want their kids to do practical things. They don't want them mucking around. Right. Did you have, were your parents or anyone?
Yeah, so my father, same thing. My parents split up when I was like in 10th grade, but they were kind of like not getting along for like pretty much the whole time before that.
Sorry to hear that.
Yeah, no, that's okay. I've gotten over
By
that.
By the way, I say I'm sorry. I know it wasn't my fault. I had no part in this. I just...
Not only was it not your fault, but it's like, you know, you don't need to...
It's a thing we say. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
And also, no, you're talking to a Canadian. We're sorry about everything. That's the stereotype. Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah. I'm sorry I had any part in... I mean, I am sorry if I've brought something up that's sensitive. How about that? That's where I'm coming from.
No. Oh, thank you. Yeah, no, it's not sensitive at all. But I'd say that So my mom was always the kind of person that was like, do whatever the fuck you want. You know, like she didn't care.
Oh, lovely.
Honestly, about any, you know, she was always like, whatever you make you happy, fine with me. You know, my father was not down, you know, it was always like, you know, you have to figure out how that can be your hobby, you know, or whatever.
Same here. Yeah.
But I didn't actually have much communication with him for many years, so I didn't have to hear it. So
they were both doctors, you were saying?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So that's a hard, that's what they think you should do or something. Yeah, it's weird. It's weird. Don't they know how hard it is to be an artist, how hard you have to work? Almost harder, I would think, somehow.
Yeah.
Not maybe, I don't know, that's a debate.
Yeah, I would say so.
Yeah,
you know?
Yeah,
sure.
Yeah.
You don't, no one's telling you what the next thing or how anything's going to go, you know? You can't be like, if I take this step, I know that this thing will be the result. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Although I guess people don't know that in general anywhere anymore, really. So
yeah, that's fair. So you moved to Chicago. You've got a band. How does your relationship with Drag City Records sort of begin?
Oh, that's like a decade later. Like, you know, we had Scissor Girls had this like whole thing. You know, we had a bunch of records. And then after that, I had a second band, Bride of Nono. And then so this is like 12 years later that I did the first Drag City thing.
Right.
So.
And that relationship began just what, Chicago friendliness?
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, a little bit, but also like, I don't actually know. I mean, yeah, we were friends and stuff. And then I was doing this solo record and they were interested in hearing it, you know? And so I did this like sort of like private little impromptu performance for them at the Hideout, this place in Chicago that, you know.
I've been there.
Pretty much everyone plays there. Yeah, okay. Yeah. There was a piano on stage, you know, that's a nice piano on stage. I can't remember why there was somebody had it for like their show.
Okay.
You know, so they had rented it. And so I just read this. Like, I read this about myself recently, and that's how I know this. I would not remember this at all. Apparently, it's Jim Becker from Caliphone. Apparently, he called me and was like, hey, there's this piano here. You want to do something? And I arranged for those guys to come, and we did this little, like, sort of audition, or I don't know what you want to call it.
You read this in a, what, like a magazine or something?
Yeah. I think somebody was like, here's this old, I don't even remember where this was. A friend of mine recently sent me an old interview with me that I had forgotten existed. And it might have been in that. I don't remember. Or I might have seen something where Jim Becker is quoted as saying it, or I don't know.
Oh.
So, yeah, it's somewhere, some press that I read in conjunction right now since I put this record out, with either with it being something someone wrote in relation to this record, or it being that a friend of mine shared with me something because they saw that I had a new record. I don't know.
Okay. All right. No, I appreciate that.
But I think
that's
what, so it looks like that's what's happening. I have a really bad time remembering the actuality of what happened in many of these cases. So that's what I'm going
to
go with.
This takes us back to your time in the 80s where you were finding yourself, maybe losing yourself and finding yourself at the same time. Yeah.
It's not that. It's just that there's a lot of, I think I have a very good memory for the details that I want to remember. You know what I mean? Or that seemed significant to me at the time. I'm sure everybody does.
Our brains are weird. Aren't our brains weird? They remember things we don't need and they forget things we want. It's the weirdest system.
It's true.
Yeah. Anyway, it's odd. I appreciate all that background. And I think this all started with me asking if your family was funny. And that's where we landed. We went all over the place. But no, I think that's significant. I do want to kind of.
I hope you can edit this if you want. Otherwise, there might be a lot of like junk in it.
I'm bound by law to publish the whole thing. I can't edit any of it.
Okay.
Yeah, word for word. No, I could, but it was interesting. It wasn't
I see.
It wasn't not interesting. You think there's a law, a podcast law?
I believed you.
That I have to.
I don't know. For a second, I believed you.
No.
I don't know what Canada is like. If there was a law like that in Canada, I would think it's probably for a good reason.
We have less libel bullshit here than you do. Yeah. Like, I mean, for better or for worse, people can say and do almost anything they want, and no one's going to Donald Trump them in court, you know, sue everyone.
Yeah.
Anyway, no, unless you're unhappy with the things you revealed, I thought it was very interesting. And I do want to get us to Glen Echo.
Yeah.
Because my understanding is that I mentioned this, I think, earlier. You played everything on this record by yourself. Was that a first for you, playing songs completely?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah? And
well,
what?
Yeah. In the making of all of my records, all of these records that I've written by myself, you know, that weren't like band records, I always have made like pretty extensive demos, you know, going back to the first one, you know. And in some cases, like Life on the Fly, that's like 2004, I had done like, you know, Muzak versions of all the other instruments and things, you know.
Yeah.
Not necessarily the parts that, for example, the bass player would play, but like things like, in some cases, yes, like a riff or something, you know. So anyways, I've had these. And then, you know, in almost all of the cases, we then go in with a band and, practice the songs, learn them, make them into new things, and then, like, and then record that, you know?
Right.
And then there was always a thing, I would say, even, you know, there was always a thing where I would then go and hear an old demo and be like, oh, there's something about that. That didn't come out by the time it was finished, you know?
Yeah.
And in this case, I was working on these for a while, and I had all the guitar, fake drums, like, you know, like program drums.
Yeah.
And
was it the program drums where you was it an electric drum kit where you physically play the drum kit, or was it?
No.
Oh, okay.
No, it's computer. And, you know, some of the bass parts were recorded already, you know.
Okay,
And vocals, lyrics, you know, like all. So you know, a percentage of the record was already in demo form, right? And these are the demos that I would then give to, like, my bandmates when we have shows for them to learn the songs or whatever, because, like, you know, the people I play with now, you know, like, one has children, you know, like, people don't want to practice for more than, like, two or three times before a show. Like, it's just, like, it's not like, you know, my
easy
old bands where
yeah
we would practice, like, three times a week or whatever. This is, like, you know, it's hard to get three practices, you know, in 6 months' time. You know,
aren't children the worst? I used to when I played in bands, like,
they're ruining the world.
We would practice for hours, like 5 hours at a time, and we'd really practice a lot because you need to, so that you're not.
It's not just that though. You know, people have like, you know, 10 bands they're in.
Yeah.
You know, very. Yeah.
Yeah. No, I get it. I get it. Yeah.
So, you know, like I said, some of these songs were written in like 2015, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So I had these demos, and we had done another little small EP thing with Bobby Kahn, this thing for this Baudelaire project that this theater group does here, where we write songs using Baudelaire poems.
And
in that case, I had also done some demos and then redone some of it in the studio with the band. And it was fresh on my mind how the groove will move from the thing, you know, like how it'll become a different groove
right.
by the time you're done.
Right.
You know, once like new time, like you're tracking it in a new time feel. And then some. Then now it's up to like how the band establishes the feel of it. And I just wasn't like feeling like I wanted to have that happen with this record. Like to start it over and then like be like, it's almost like you're analyzing whether you like something or not based on an entirely new set of criteria, you know? Because now it's like it's a completely different thing. And I just, the idea of going into that experience with these things that I had become really fond of, I wasn't really liking it. At the same time, I didn't want to keep my fake drums. So I was like, do I want, you know, Adam, who plays drums with me, to come and re-record these parts for me along to the demo? Like, you know, like I was just kind of, and it was like David Berman was with me at this like Drag City thing. And he was like, no, you have to do it yourself. He's like, it'll be boring if it's other people. He's like, it's got to be you. You got to do everything. like that, you know.
David has a way of being very persuasive, I know. As for
yeah. So he did persuade me. Yeah. He persuaded me that I should learn how to do it. He's like, you'll learn it. Just go learn it and do it. You know, and then like, yeah, I have texts with him where he's like, hey, you want to come out and eat? We're having dinner. You know, we're going to go out to dinner. And I'm like, no, I'm here learning how to play the fucking drums because you said, you know, and he's like, oh, it's going to be great. I can't wait to hear it. And then, of course, I was done with it like a month before this, you know, horrible thing happened. And I was just like, that was my first like irrational, selfish thought was like, I just fucking finished my record, you asshole.
Yeah.
You know?
Keeps coming up on the show again lately. And
yeah.
It's hard for me as a fan and someone who got to know him a very little bit, but it's hard.
Yeah.
And, he was very, the more that I hear, like I had a conversation with Corey Hansen, also a Drag City label mate. And he said, yeah, David snapped him out of it. David encouraged him, like out of some malaise he was having, David snapped him out of it and encouraged him and offered like kind of coach Berman, like just sort of coaching him into what to do or what he thought he could do. And Corey said it was revelatory. Like it did really help him to have. And yeah, when I was down and David would email me or message me about something, I always felt lifted up. It was just a power and a magical quality he had. So I understand why. I understand your frustration, disappointment, and but also your belief that he might have been right and that you should do everything yourself. So you ended up recording real drums. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, I had to learn how to do it, but then I did it, yeah.
Because there are times on the record where I'm like...
where the drums are not as slick
as there are times where, as a seasoned music listener, as a musician myself who's made records, you'd be like, well, that's a little off, but, you know, the spirit is there. There seem to be a couple instances there because you're doing everything yourself. It is hard, isn't it, to line everything up, to sync everything, to get the right feel for every instrument, right?
Yeah, I would say that there are certainly going to be elements in the drums that are like not that are unslick, you know,
sure.
Hopefully not amateurish. I don't know what somebody's going to call it. You know, it's the thing I was least confident about because I'd only been doing it for a year. You know,
It's not amateurish. It's just like
So I wanted to say that like. Sometimes when someone says that about something, like about, I don't know about this, like I had, you know, somebody, I don't need to say who, was like, this one part, it has five beats all of a sudden, you know, and I'm like, no, that's how I had the drum machine programmed. This, like that, that's the part. Like, I don't care how good I ever get, I would play that, you know, like,
right.
Like, yeah, I think that so yes, both of those things. One of them is that the drums are unslick. The second thing is that not every sort of awkward choice that you might hear is to be attributed to that, I guess.
Yeah, fair enough. Because
also the unslick drums were tightened up like in editing and stuff too, and yet some things were deliberately left the way that they were when they could have been, you know, smoothed into a loop or something very, you know. So,
well, I will say it brings a smile to my face when I hear like the end of Online Life or something where like that instrumental section where to my ear, it's like a little it's charmingly chaotic or something like it's just everything seems like it's just I like it. I'm not like don't get me wrong, Zita. I'm not criticizing Anything.
I won't. But I am touchy about my wishing that I, like, well, we can get into that later. But, like I could definitely make the drums more to my liking if I were to have tracked it last year with all this time on my hands, you know?
Yeah.
But, of course, yeah, so.
Well, it's of a time. So, I guess the other, I think, sort of significant thing is that you kind of left keyboards behind and switched to guitar. Do you have a perspective on what prompted that?
Yeah, it's really simple, actually. I don't, it's not like any kind of like, you know, I did a fully piano and voice record for the last like major record. I'm not talking about a year. I'm talking about Disturbing the Air, where it's all piano pretty much.
Yeah.
And so like, you know, playing shows is a very difficult thing, right? Like, it's like, what are you going to do? You know, like, are you either, like, I had a show at the Chicago, like, what's it called? Millennium Park, right?
Yeah.
And I got to use their 9-foot Steinway that, like, the CSO uses. And I was like, this is an instrument. You know, like, this is something where I can just, like, dream on this instrument and make sounds and I can feel like it's giving me something back, right? This is what a piano feels like, right?
Yeah.
You can't get that from an electric keyboard, you know, like, of any kind. You know, like, well, I'm not going to count, like, you know, mechanical ones like Rhodes or whatever. Like, that's a different thing totally,
sure.
Right? But, like, there's no way to do that unless you have a piano. You know, and not even like a shitty piano, like not even just like the piano that's like an upright that's at some bar or something, right? But like a night, you need a nice fucking piano for that kind of sense.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
And every guitar player or horn player or whatever gets to experience that, right? Like everybody who brings their own instrument gets to experience that, mm-hmm. you know? Mm-hmm. And for me, it was like not going to be possible for almost, you know, for 90% of cases, right? And I had just come from doing a bunch of shows there with the Handsome Family opening for them where, you know, I was playing a electric keyboard, a MIDI controller or whatever.
Yeah.
And I was like, I just never want to do that again. Like, I just never want to have that feeling again. You know, I don't care if it's Nord. I don't care what the fuck it is. I you can make it as nice as you want to. At the end of the day, you're pressing a button and you're hearing a sampled recording of a piano. Like, I don't want that.
It's not real to you. Like, yeah, yeah.
It doesn't, like, you know, it's so far away from being a, you know. And then it's like, why would I want to do that? Like, I would maybe want to do that if I had to play in, like, paradoxically, the situation where you're least likely to have that is like, you know, if there's money and there's tons of people in the audience, you know, then okay, you have something to interact with. You don't have to think about the instrument, right? But when you're like by yourself in a bar or something, you know, like on a trip and there's like three people in the audience,
yeah.
you know, and then you're standing there and you're not even getting anything back from your instrument. You're just like pressing keys on an electric keyboard. Like that'll like drive you to suicide, man. Like that's like a horrible feeling.
Yeah.
It's like, what the fuck am I doing? Right.
So piano and keys, like that's if you had a first instrument, those are probably your first instruments. By the sounds of it, drums are very new for you.
Yeah.
Where does guitar lie in that categorization system that I just invented? Is it something you've been playing a long time or is it new?
Well, I played bass as my what I thought was my first instrument. How's that? You know, instrument in a band in Scissor Girls and in Bride of Nona when I completely forgot that I'd ever played the piano at all was bass, right? And I did that for all of the 90s and the beginning of the 2000s. I was a bass player, right? And somewhere in the mid-90s is when I went back to piano as a sort of like a thing on the side and I didn't really know how I was going to use it and I was playing, you know, just like classical and stuff and ragtime. So
did your piano lessons come back to you? Did you have any muscle memory?
No. I mean, I had a really bad experience with piano lessons when I was a kid. Like I didn't retain anything from it. So,
I see. Okay.
So I didn't, you know, like.
Okay. No, it's, you like the piano. You don't love the piano. You're not in love with a piano.
No. Yeah. That's not fair. I'm in love with some things with a piano. What I'm not in love with is fake keyboards, you know, like fake piano keyboards.
Yeah, yeah, sure, fair.
And I'm not, you know, yeah, like the things that I have bigger thoughts about it than is just like, you know, do I like this instrument or do I not like this instrument? You know what I mean? Like, there's but anyway, sorry, I got a little bit, my I got a little bit distracted.
It sounds like that happens. That happens to you sometimes. You get a little distracted.
I think it happens to you too. I'm pretty sure.
No. I'm very focused on. Yeah, no, it does happen to me. I get distracted. There's a lot going on in the world. No, it's fair. I'm just asking questions because
let me answer your other question though.
Yeah,
I played some guitar on my 2009 record, How Will You. There's a few songs I play guitar on that, if I recall correctly. There's two, maybe three. And I wrote a little bit on guitar for my second record, for Life on the Fly. But I started, it was that experience of playing this Millennium Park show on the Steinway, on the CSO Steinway,
yeah,
that I was like, I need my own fucking instrument that I can walk around with and feel like I can play it and get something from it. You know, so I started kind of like playing more guitar then, and that was, I want to say, 2014 maybe, I don't know.
Okay, so there's some familiarity to some of this newness that has been sort of ascribed to this batch of songs. What about self-engineering? Is that something you've done before a lot of?
I mean you know, like I've done various aspects of things like that since even, you know, my first quote-unquote solo record was my work at the Art Institute in the sound department. It was all like tape recording and various sound art. And, you know, I ran live sound for a long time at the Fireside Bowl here and a little bit at the Empty Bottle. Hmm. And I've been around it a lot, and I have various experience with it. And I've been recording on the computer. I've been recording my, you know, demos for all of these solo records, but also like other things really since like the 90s, right? So I have some stuff, but I didn't know how to, you know, like record drums. I had to like investigate a little bit how to do all that.
Yeah.
Some things, I guess, with equipment and various mics and things
mics,
I
had
to
deal
with. But just insofar as how it applies to, I guess, getting good sounds for a record. But
it just seems like this is really a lot of self-assertion. I mean, and this is prior, like I say, this is prior to a pandemic that forced a lot of people to go this route of like, I got to play everything, I got to record everything. So you were kind of, whether you meant to or not, meant to be or not, you were kind of on to something, I guess, weirdly. And it sounds like you took this on as a way of challenging yourself and learning about a lot of things. Is that fair?
No, that's not fair. That's not why I took it on. I took it on because, like, there's this, the songs are there and they have to be finished, you know, and this is what they require. Like, that's the reason why they're like this, right? These songs were not going to work if they were just, like, totally redone and had a different groove. They had to be the way that they, and there was really no other way to make that happen. So that's, you know, it was like the thing followed its need to happen the way that it did, you know?
Well, I retract my statement, Your Honor. I didn't mean to suggest. My goodness, I didn't realize. Well, I don't.
By the way, if my tone is ever brusque or seemingly annoyed, I just want to say it's a cultural thing. It's my Iranian-ness. It has nothing. I'm not really annoyed, nor am I. You know, I didn't take offense to that.
If that's an Iranian hallmark, I feel like, you know, I've been wrestling with this. I think Indians are nosy. Like, people are like, how do you get into journalism and asking all these people these questions? I'm like, I think, if I think about it, just nosiness. It's not anything else. It's just like, tell me what's going on there. Hey, what's going on? Not gossipy even, just nosy. They were very brazenly nosy, my parents. So anyway, no, it is what it is. I appreciate that. Even if that wasn't your intention then to challenge and learn, sounds like that happened. No. You learned things. And
but I learned things from every single one of these records. You know, like they all had like particular challenges that were like, you know, and I don't even know that it's not kind of any kind of straight line where it's like necessarily the thing you learned will be obviously applicable to the next thing. But, you know, sometimes I guess it is.
Yeah. You used the word applicable there. This batch of songs stretches back, it sounds like, at least 6 years, if not more.
The writing period of these songs is probably between 2015 and done by 2017. So kind of like the writing was done in those kind of like 2 years there.
Yeah. Okay.
You know, and then recording took a while, and then mixing, like waiting for getting into the Wilco loft and like whatever, and like going back and fixing shit and whatever, like that took a while.
Got it.
And
yeah.
Then, you know, mastering, and then the pandemic.
Yeah. No, I gathered all that from before. Where I was coming from though with the lyrics and the songwriting is yeah. now that you have, like, so yeah, 2015 to 2017 roughly is when you yeah. got these ideas lyrically out of your self and onto the page mm-hmm. and whatever, you recorded them. Do you have any kind of perspective on them now that it's 2021? Do you feel like, was there anything prescient writing, like, you know, given what we're going through right now? And like, even online life, I don't know that it has anything. We are living these online lives. And yeah. I don't know that you were necessarily commenting on that at the same. But at the same time, I mean, in terms of what we're going through now, like our fixation yeah. on it. But do you see some prescience here and there? Like, oh, some of this stuff that I was.
I thought the opposite, right? Like, I finished that. That was the second song.
Yeah.
It was kind of written at the same time as the first song. And this was all taking so long to be done, even before the coronavirus hit. And then that was supposed to be the first single, right? That was supposed to come out. And it was supposed to come out pretty much right around that time, like April, right? Like, right when the COVID started. And I was like, this song is not going to work now, you know, because the song was how to erase your online life. And all of a sudden it's like, well, that's all there is. Like, how could you erase? You know what I mean? Like, that's not going to, nobody is going to be like jamming to this song right now. Like, it's totally irrelevant. I was afraid it would never make sense to anyone again, you know, and I would be like, that's the thing, right? That's the thing with, like, I'm guessing that comedians experience this, right? Where it's like, I think it's actually maybe even in a David Berman poem or something about what a short lifespan comedy has, right?
Yeah.
Like, in terms of, you know, well, you know, like, think of that for music, but then you also can't just, like, go out that night and say your jokes on a stage. You got to wait till the fucking music is written and the record is mixed and, you know, like, so, like, there's this, like, lag in how long it takes to get from when you put the ideas out to when it's done, that I'm always, like, sort of battling that things aren't going to have any relevance by the time it's done, you know, because I'm not a quick worker, obviously. I hope to one day be, but so far I haven't cracked that, you know, that nut.
Yeah.
So,
well,
so I was just going to say that I didn't think it was going to be relevant. And then luckily, at a certain point, it seemed like it was okay. So it's nice to hear you say that, because I feel like a little bit like it's like an old person's joke or something now.
Well, no,
you know?
But I think what happened is, I think in the first year of the pandemic, some of us were like pretty grateful that we had been trained like monkeys to live online and function online.
Yeah.
And now the exhaustion is really hitting lots of people. And I'm seeing more people say, yeah, I got to get out. I'm deleting all my accounts. I'm not necessarily to erase their online life because of things they've, I mean, as we're speaking, there have been a few instances recently where someone's past posts are coming back to haunt them. They've lost jobs or whatnot.
Right.
So that's still going on.
Yeah.
And I think that was going on probably around the time you wrote this song, really, as well. But
yeah.
on a grander scale, I think when you talk about, like, how to erase your online life, we're getting to that. Like, this life, these lives we've been living since the pandemic aren't enough. And I think we're starting to realize that. And so people are, like, pulling back from living online lives. So in a weird way, I get what you're saying about how it maybe doesn't feel as relevant, but I would argue that now that we're on the other side, or at this point, I should say, of the pandemic, it's starting to make more sense. People are starting to disengage a bit from this.
Yeah.
So kudos to you. I hope people I hope people spend time with the lyric sheet as much as they do the sound of the songs, if that makes any sense. So,
yeah.
Really?
I do too. That's why I don't know if you have the vinyl, but that's why it's the entire, it's the entire gatefold interior is just lyrics. I like, that's why my shit takes so long, is that. That's not, you know, if I just had to come up with just these sounds, it would be not the same thing at all. You know?
Like, no rush. You say it shit takes so long. No one's rushing you. This is good. It's good. You took your time. It came out when it came out. Who? Why?
Well, you saw, what was it? The Spotify guy or whatever was like, these artists can't.
Oh, yeah.
Thinking they're going to release a record every 4 years. And, you know, and I'm like, fuck you. You go write a record. Let's see what kind of quality it is. You know,
yeah.
you think that someone's going to release like a fucking important record with like a lot to say every like 6 months? Like, no, you can get like three sound bites. You know, that a lot of things are that way now, right? There's like one sound bite per song. Like, it's like, there's a two chord progression. There's like a, like if you look at the lyrics, there's like, you know, six lines of lyrics and they just like repeat, you know what I mean? And it's like, that's the material of the song. Well, you know, this is why.
I don't want to allege anything or speculate, but Spotify guy might have an agenda. That's all I'll say. Like, I think might be, he might want more stuff for some reason. I don't know why, but yeah. What is next for you? I mean, you talk about this batch of songs coming out or being done for you, really. Around 2017, so that's 4 years ago. Have you been? Yeah. Have you written a bunch more since then? And are you? Do you have plans to satisfy Spotify guy and maybe put out a new record sooner rather than later?
I would like to put out a new record sooner rather than later. I can't say much about where I am in that process, though.
Okay. Okay. Yeah. Because it's a secret? Because Spotify guy might be listening?
No, it's just that, like, I don't. Absolutely not because of that. No, because like.
No, I'm kidding.
Like,
I'm kidding.
A process for something needs to just be respected, right? Like, it needs to...
No, it's fair. I just... I'm curious, too, because your country has had this cataclysmic calamity since you started writing this record.
What, the Trump administration, or is there another one? Like, the thing...
Well, the Trump administration is a catch-all, but it has wrought so much other stuff, and it's because of him, frankly, and them. So I'm not saying they're exclusive, but yeah, I mean... Obviously, there's been a lot of turmoil in your country in particular that has been exacerbated by your leadership. And so I'm just saying, if you've written a batch of songs that didn't get, that may not have that floating in the air when you were writing them, not to say that they wouldn't necessarily make it onto a record, you know, but I'm just saying stuff like that is in the atmosphere.
I find it really, I mean, like, I do follow a lot of politics and I'm obviously a strong opinionated person. I don't find it easy to use that in direct, I mean, like in a direct way in what I write for songs. Like, there is some on this record, you know, that you can find. There are some I guess things you could consider political situations, but
they're subtle and artful. I mean, if someone were to look at your lyric sheet and see a couplet, "What a fat lot of good, how America shot itself in the foot," coming out in 2021, they might be like, "Oh." You know,
that was written before Trump, you know, and I don't know if you know about the title and the park, you know, but the Glen Echo Park was whites only park for until like, I think it's like 1961, where they finally, you know, through protests and things, desegregated it. And then it, you know, within the next few years, it went through what happened in a lot of desegregated places in the States, which is that, like, the white people fled, you know, so and it ended up shutting down. So in that song, you know, like, I am getting a tour of the park, and there's a nostalgic thing happening with all the things that it could be and the things of, like, dreams, you know. At the same time, there's, like, a dude, you know, who was there, you know, when I was writing this, he's at the park and he's like, he's living out of his hatchback and he's telling me that, like, he just lost all of his, you know, his house in the foreclosure crisis. And it's so tied together, right? It's like this thing where it's like, you know, white people were cheating themselves out of everything, you know, everything that society was providing from them, with this idea that if black people can have it too, we don't want to share, we don't want it at all. And now, you know, there's no healthcare. So it's like, you know, there's actually a book about this now, but like that was like the sort of, that's what that line is kind of referring to.
Yeah. Yeah. And as I look through the lyrics and think of the song and what you're saying, that starts to resonate with me more. And so you are, I think, a socially conscious and observational writer, but it's subtle on some level at the same time, or it requires a little more of a deeper read. We need to spend time with Azita, I think, to to figure things out.
I'm kind of wishing we hadn't spent so much on my you know, Discord shows.
No, come on, that was fun. That was all good. I appreciate that. What I was gonna say is, if people want to learn more about you and the record Glen Echo, you know, using the online life that we lead, where would you like to send them?
You know, the Bandcamp, Drag City's website, like YouTube. Facebook, it has links to shit.
Do you have, like, yourself? Do you have, like, things that you would like people to follow? Like, I think we became Instagram buddies.
That's just recent. Yeah, I was like, okay, I'll start this thing because it does seem like some people have fled for Instagram. Although I really dislike, it doesn't appeal to me. It doesn't appeal to me the way the things are on there, you know. But I'm like, okay.
Do you like Facebook?
I like conversations. In case you can't tell, you know, like I'm a words person, and like it's like people are like, well, there's less political stuff on Instagram, and it's like, yeah, because no one is having any conversations about anything. That's why there's no political stuff, you know. So it's it's very dystopian, isn't it? It's like we got the humans to agree not to talk about anything anymore by presenting them with the ability to just post pictures, you know.
That's fair. Yeah, that's a fair point. I think it's, and I know Facebook owns Instagram, yeah, so we're not like, really doing much better. I do think part of it for me, because I stopped using Facebook as much, is I think the data mining also, it's not like I was never engaged in these heated, you know, political conversations with some weird uncle that I have, you know, I never really saw too much of that. But at the same time, the data mining and the sharing of information, like, I don't know, something about it seemed wrong. And so maybe you're right. Like, maybe they've just got us to shut up and show things instead of talking about things.
Yeah, so like the tree across the street from my house, it's like, okay. I mean, there's still ads, right? I'm sure there's still some kind of data mining. There's less to mine because, okay, you know.
Well, it's the same company. I struggle with this too. Like, if I'm mad at Facebook for their data mining and I'm using their other thing, and they own so many of these things now that you can't really, I'm sure, what do they do? Anyway, you're probably onto something, but I just found it. Anyway, that's just, we can go. Anyway, you like Facebook. You're on there.
I don't say I like it. Please.
Sorry.
It's what it is, man. It's how people, it's where shit is. It's where, you know, it's where there are some kind of things that you can find out about someone's show or something, you know? But, you know,
yeah, it's informational. So, yeah. I've been using Twitter and Instagram more for that stuff, which is weird because Twitter, remember like 4 years ago, everyone hated Twitter? Twitter's the worst.
I also have a Twitter account, just like I've had these like lurking accounts, and I'm like, one day I will make a thing. I will make it public or whatever. I have the same thing on Twitter. I just haven't done anything with it.
All right. Well, people can learn more about you at dragcity.com. I guess there's one place.
Go to my Facebook Azita Band page if they want to look at Facebook. If they want to look at Instagram, they can go look at it there. There's not that much there. you know. This is the fucking internet. You used to just put it into Google and then you'd find the thing you want.
Like, I know.
Now people are like, give me one place so I don't have to search.
Well, I brought it. I know it might be weird, but I always offer this space at the end because people will have. We just had a 5-minute conversation about whether or not Facebook was valid or not. And that's what I get. People are like, you know, I don't use Instagram the way I used to. Now I use Cameo. Like, they'll just pick a thing. So I don't...
Yeah.
I ask because I just want to know what people are using. And, you know, you and I are maybe around the same age. You're probably a little bit older than me. But my point is, like, I'm just curious what people of my vintage and younger and older are using. Like, I'm just curious.
Yeah.
Because we have so many options. And if
nothing
you told
is
me
good,
you
though, right? There's no good options. A good time for the internet was like, you know, I don't know, when it was seemed like anything was possible. It seems to be gone now.
Well, in any event, the record's fantastic, and I was hoping we could go out on a song from Glen Echo. And Azita, I'm hoping you can both pick the song we go out on, but maybe even if we haven't already talked about it, maybe tell us a little bit about why you chose it. Are those things you can do?
Well, I really like to hear Our Baby, so I think maybe that's good enough that I just like to hear it. It's maybe one of the later ones that kind of came together, and so it's because it sort of feels new to me, and I just think it's a nice vibe. So maybe.
Is it about a baby?
It's about a idea that if we were to talk about it, would take up a lot more time.
All right. So. I would like to hear more about it, but at the same time, I do. Well, I appreciate that. I also think we'll leave it to people to interpret things. Get the lyric sheet out.
Good.
Spend some time with the song. Okay, we'll go out on that right now. This is Our Baby by Azita from their excellent new record, Glen Echo. Azita, this was, I hope, fun. For you. And I hope we speak again, and best of luck with everything in the future.
Thank you. Thanks.
not have a lot going on. Presented a calm
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Hey, everyone. I'm Craig Robinson, co-host of the Ways to Win podcast, alongside my good friend John Calipari. I've been on the go recently, Phoenix, Kansas City, Chicago. If you're like me and have a home but aren't always at home, you have an Airbnb. Hosting your home or a spare room is a very practical side hustle. If you live in a big game town, you can Airbnb your place for fans to stay in. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Oh, very special thanks to Azita for appearing on this, the 613th episode of Creative Control, which is part of the Entertainment One podcast network and is available wherever it is in the world that you get your podcasts. If you can't find an episode that you're looking for, or if you wish to learn more about me and sign up for my monthly newsletter, which I'm behind schedule on as we're speaking, please visit my website, vishkana.com. You can like Creative Control on Facebook. You can follow the show on Twitter directly at Vish Creative with a K, or you can follow me on Twitter and on Instagram at Vish Khanna with a K. You can also visit patreon.com/creativecontrol to make a flexible monthly donation to sustain this program. It's all really, all the revenue really comes from people like you listening who go to patreon.com/creativecontrol and make a donation. Now, your donation can be in any amount whatsoever, really. Maybe it's a minimum of a dollar. I really don't know. And you can modify it or cancel it at any time. I should say that $6 or more a month grants you access to exclusive content. And if you're interested in receiving a Creative Control t-shirt and you're at that $6 or more level, please message me on Patreon and I will get you one while supplies last. I want to thank some people right now. I want to thank Pizza Trocadero, The Bookshelf, and Planet Bean Coffee in Guelph, and Granddad's Donuts in Hamilton for their in-kind support for this show. I hope they're all doing okay. I'm away from them, so I don't know. I missed the donuts and the coffee and the books and the pizza. I forgot about the pizza, and that's my first sponsorship, the pizza. Oh, I missed the pizza. I'd also like to thank Jim Guthrie. He's like a little slice of pizza in his own way. He lets me use some music on the show, and you can learn more about him and his work at his website, jimguthrie.org. He's got a lot of it, so buckle up, buttercup, and strap in. Listen to Jim's music. Just spend all day at jimguthrie.org. And finally, thank you for listening to this episode with Azita. I hope you enjoyed it, and we'll check out her new record, Glen Echo, and her amazing catalog of music at Drag City, on Drag City, but at Drag City. .com there. And if you like, please, if you want to, subscribe to this podcast and tell your friends about the show. Maybe they'll check it out and like it, and they'll subscribe to it or keep tabs on it or whatever it is people do these days. Spread the word about the show. That's all that you can really do, and it's all I can do, and I hope that's what happens. Anyway, whatever it is you do, I appreciate you for listening. Thank you very much. I will talk to you soon. Goodbye for now.
Tired of ads barging into your favorite news podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay up to date on everything newsworthy by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/newsadfree. That's amazon.com/newsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods
for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.